This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Mike and Scott. This story is from our episode, Who We Are at Core. You can subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts. There's always this tension between who we think we are and how others see us. In this story, we look at this tension in the context of cognitive abilities. When a person has dementia, loses their memories, and starts to act in ways that we really don't recognize, are they still the same person? Jad Slaman reports.
Esther Honig was the type of daughter with questions, lots of them.
You know, when I was little, it was things like mummies and dinosaurs. And, you know, I would just ask him questions as if he was an expert.
And her father, Jordan, was the type of dad who tried to find answers.
My dad loved to learn. He loved science. We would go to museums together. He would talk to me about things that he had read.
Jordan was incredibly smart, a sculptor turned mechanical engineer who had a habit of hijacking Esther's science fair projects. In retrospect, it was her father's brilliance that masked what started happening to him when Esther was still in high school. First, Jordan started having trouble with really advanced math.
My mom remembers that it was probably around 2006 or 2007 that he came to her and he said, I can't do my work. He was having trouble doing these math problems that he needed to do for his job.
Then his sense of humor took a hit. Jordan was funny. He had dad jokes for days, and actually pretty good ones. Here's a classic from after he saw Esther's first tattoo.
It's like a small little tooth.
Her recently removed wisdom tooth.
He told me so much for wisdom that it's such a dad joke.
He was always making little jokes, getting laughs out of the strangers in line with him at Starbucks. But that quickness, that was the next thing to go.
It was just weird. It was weird to see him talk to friends or, you know, it hurts me to say this, but it was really embarrassing, you know? Like, you'd see him strike up a conversation and he didn't really, like, hit the notes that he would have normally. You know, he wouldn't really, that joke that he'd told didn't really land. And people would kind of be like, yeah, like, you know, like, people kind of walk away being like, oh, okay, yeah.
Things got worse in kind of a cascading way. He forgot little details of his day at first, then how to get home from the grocery store. He lost his job, really, because he couldn't do any of the work anymore.
This was well before he had ever been diagnosed with anything. We didn't realize what was happening.
Esther's dad, still in his 50s, had early onset Alzheimer's. Over the next few years, as Jordan lost more independence, moved into an assisted living facility, Esther got the same question a lot. A question pretty much everyone with a loved one with Alzheimer's gets. Does he still know who you are?
I remember I asked him how many daughters he had, and he could tell me about my oldest sister. And okay, Dad, okay, so who was your second daughter, and when was she born? Okay, well then there was mine. Yeah, that's the middle child in our family.
Esther was the third daughter, the youngest.
And then I asked him, and is there anyone else? You know, what about your other daughter? And I don't have another daughter. You know, he had completely, I mean. It wasn't anything personal. It wasn't like I was the least favorite or anything like that.
She knew, all right, I'm the most recent daughter, so there's just fewer Esther memories in Dad's head to begin with, and all his memories are getting chewed up by this disease. But despite that, at core, this version of Jordan still felt like Dad. At the assisted living facility, Jordan still had his social prowess. He was kind of a hit, made all these friends. And other things, too. For example, his fussiness about food was still there.
These little parts of him that managed to peek through the fog, you know? Like, there would be just so little about him that I could relate to, that I could connect to. And then suddenly there'd be something like, you know, well, of course he's complaining about the lunch that they served at Village Shalom. You know, when has Jordan ever been happy with a meal that he didn't cook, you know?
As time went on, though, these little peaks of Jordan would start showing up less and less often. The healthy Jordan she had grown up with would become more and more distant. As the Alzheimer's progressed, as it changed Jordan, took his memories and more, how long would it be until he became a total stranger to her? How long would her dad still be the same person at his core? This gets at a fundamental question about memories and the self. Nina Strominger is a psychologist and cognitive scientist. She tries to get at these questions through the lens of philosophy. She studied the self, or our ideas of the self, who we think we are, who we think others are, basically what makes us who we are as individuals. For example, she turns to John Locke, one of the most influential 17th century Enlightenment thinkers. Locke argued it had to do with memory.
So what makes us who we are is our memories. And actually, if you look at this case that he discusses...
Locke used this story of a prince and a cobbler who magically swap souls.
If the soul of a prince inhabits the body of a cobbler, everyone sees, he says, everyone sees, it's self-evident that this new entity is the prince.
In this soul swap, they swap minds as well.
Classically, this has been interpreted as him saying it's not just the mind of the prince, it is the episodic or autobiographical memories of the prince.
The cobbler gets princely memories, and he becomes, to any observer, princely. But Nina respectfully disagrees. She says her research has found that people don't consider their memories the biggest part of who they are.
I tell people about, you know, it's the year 2049, and Jim gets into a car accident, and he loses part of his brain, it gets damaged, and the scientists have to insert a microchip into his brain to restore that part of his brain that's just been lost.
But there's a trade-off. Option one?
One of the versions says, now all of his memories are gone from his past life, right? So this is the condition where we say, we've obliterated the autobiographical memories.
The other option, he remembers everything, but...
he no longer has a moral compass. He no longer knows the difference between right and wrong. He's lost his moral conscience.
Overwhelmingly, people say this future Jim is no longer Jim, not when he forgets his entire life, but when he forgets right from wrong.
They just say, because you're a monster if you don't know the difference between right and wrong. You're just a completely different person.
Nina took that same question of losing your memories versus moral compass to the caregivers of people with different neurodegenerative diseases.
In addition to asking them about the extent of different psychological changes the patient had undergone since their diagnosis, we also asked a series of questions about who the patient was. You know, does this patient ever seem like a stranger to you? Do you feel like the patient has changed deep down? Do you ever feel like you don't recognize them?
It turned out that people with a disorder called frontotemporal dementia were the least recognizable to their loved ones. Frontotemporal dementia quickly deteriorates impulse control and decision making.
I mean, this is a very kind of crude understanding of neuroanatomy, but kind of what you have left is just this wild monster version of humans.
Despite having much more intact memories than those with other cognitive illnesses, they felt like different people. In fact, when researchers broke it down by symptom, regardless of disease, memory loss was the least important factor. With Esther and her dad, early on, she still recognized him, or at least pieces of him. His moral compass, for example, was still going strong for some time. It was kind of amplified, actually.
There was actually a period where we referred to him as the rabbi. He took on a whole identity of being a rabbi. And his congregation were the people at his assisted living center. It was a whole thing. He refused to shave his beard.
But in time, that faded. Eventually, Esther's dad went from being the social butterfly at assisted living to being the opposite.
He had gotten to a place that was really scary.
It's a word Esther had never used to describe her dad, that no one had used to describe him.
He was still physically able. He was in, you know, like, again, a fairly young, healthy body. And so he could be physically dangerous to other people. He had kind of fallen into a paranoia of people being trapped, of being imprisoned.
Esther tells me it got harder and harder to see her dad. And every time she did, it would create another memory of this version of dad.
And it just killed me, you know, to see him there. There was such a small fragment of him there. It was not something I could really confidently say was my dad.
Newer, harder memories of Jordan would swell in Esther's mind with each visit as his condition deteriorated. There's more to the self than our internal perception. There's the self we see in others. And that's what was at stake for Esther.
You know, the person that they've become, each time, you know, each and every day that you live with them, that kind of erodes those golden years.
And remember, Esther was a teenager when her dad was first getting sick. Her memories of a healthy dad, full of curiosity, full of check out what I read today, they were a child's memories and fragile. Esther was trying to hold on to a very specific self, her father before he was sick. Eventually, she would have to make a decision. Would she keep visiting this new Jordan, or would she stay away? I remember Nina told me, after our hour-long talk about the self, basically that she didn't actually think it was real.
I also think that the self is a fiction or an illusion.
That's because, for one, even without dementia or Alzheimer's or anything, we're all always changing.
I am changing a lot over time, and at a psychological level, but of course, even at a cellular level, right? And we replace most of our cells about every 7 years.
So like the ship
of Theseus. Yeah.
Ship of Theseus basically asks, if you replace every plank in a boat one by one with new planks, throwing away the old original ones, when do you start considering it a different new boat?
Right. So all humans actually embody in a kind of a literal way the Ship of Theseus problem.
For Esther, clinging to that version of Jordan before the disease, the soul, the self, was real, but her idea of it was changing. The ship of her father wasn't changing plank by plank. He was becoming unrecognizable almost all at once.
My father's essence was gone while his body continued to function.
She decided to stop visiting this version of Dad in a facility in order to protect the version of Dad in her head and in her heart.
Memories are a really precious thing, and if you have the privilege to try and maintain or sort of safeguard the good memories, that's all you're going to have when they pass away.
People can get a bit judgy hearing about this type of thing, see it as abandoning a loved one, think it selfish or callous, but Esther thinks they're missing the point.
I think that it's as much a service to yourself as it is to that individual to try and remember them at their best, because that's what they would want, you know? And when they have finally passed on, those are the memories that you're going to have to try and keep them alive.
For The Pulse, I'm Jad Slaman.